Thanks for downloading this week's bonus content featuring Christopher O'Reilly's interview with emeritus host of NPR's All Things Considered, Robert Siegel. Robert's been a longtime fan of From the Top. He's had our kids on All Things Considered and has produced quite a few stories covering classical music in general. When he came to our hometown of Boston to appear at our fundraising gala, our host, Christopher O'Reilly, took the opportunity to ask him questions about his own youth and love of music.
Robert Siegel, such an honor to be with you, and thanks for being part of our gala this year.
Chris, I'm happy to be here.
Your love of classical music is no secret. You've discussed it at length on All Things Considered, but tell me, when were you first introduced to the art form? What's your earliest memory?
My earliest memories are hearing my father play records and listen to radio at home. And one summer when I was about 5 years old, I guess, I think I ruined his recording of the Emperor Concerto by playing the opening of it over and over and over again and marching around the living room of the very small bungalow we were at.
So you're marching around to the Emperor Concerto. Did you have some sort of narrative involved in your five-year-old mind?
No, I was just being very triumphant and marching around, and I thought this was pretty inspiring music. I think it may have, it must have been the first 33 LP that had been made. It may have been a Serkin performance. I'm not sure who. But I came to love it, and as I destroyed one record after another, I eventually settled on a Claudio Arrau performance that I thought was about the most perfect playing of a piece. I think it was with a Concertgebouw, and it was the most wonderful recording of music I could imagine.
So you come from very astute musical memories. I mean, was there music in the family? Did your father play, or did he just have a great record collection?
My father had a great record collection. He didn't play at all. My sister and I were expected to play, and we took piano lessons, or were sentenced to piano lessons in our view of things. And I brought a combination of a remarkable lack of talent and lack of discipline in practicing. And the one residue of doing this was, I grew up in Lower Manhattan and took lessons at the Third Street Music School, where you were required, if you took instrument lessons, to also take a theory class. So I would take the bus down when I was 11 or something, twice a week, once for my individual lesson, which was, catastrophic week after week, for 3 years or so, and then to a theory class, which things remain with me to this day from theory. And the people who were teaching us theory were professors of music or composers, conductors trying to earn some money. There was a theory teacher I had 1 year who would startle us by hopping up under the piano at a moment's notice. His name was Ralph Shapey. Went on to quite a career as a contemporary composer. And
Gadfly and...
Yes, for his sins, he had to look at six kids who would... Gerald Slattery and I would flick pistachio nutshells out the window onto Third Street when his back was turned on us. It's my only memory of Gerald Slattery. I hope he's listening.
Gosh, you were taught theory by Ralph Shapey. I mean, I'm not sure how many, University of Chicago graduates can actually say that.
Well, there you are. I mean, it was a... It was the unusual experience of taking music lessons in New York City, I think.
Robert, as you well know, our show is about teenagers and sometimes preteens. Bring us back. You've brought us back a little bit now to, your involvement in classical music. What were your teenage years like, in particular, with music? What inspired you most?
The music of my social existence was such... remarkable performances as Danny and the Juniors, or the Silhouettes doing Get a Job, which was a breakthrough moment, I remember, at that time. I went through, I'd say Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers were my ideal, I would say, rock group. I don't know if that qualifies retrospectively as rock music. And hung in there through the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Motown. And somewhere after that, after the end of college, found myself no longer interested in these things. Listened to a lot of Thelonious Monk and Sonny Rollins and And the next step after that was the strange, but I suppose predictable, return to listening to classical music.
Well, and classical music has remained a resonant part of your memory and experience.
Sure.
I know, for instance, Beethoven's Seventh occupies a rather historical moment for you.
Yes, I mean, I love the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh, the Allegretto, and as I confessed in a story that I did about it on the air, when I was news director of NPR, and when I had to listen to our programs all the time, I did have a cassette of that, queued up to that piece, which neatly covered one segment of Morning Edition, which they had, which included reruns. It was a local station insert. So I would listen and make my way through Washington, D.C. traffic, hearing this, what I think of this very, very heroic theme and struggle and great triumph, which, you know, was a little more dramatic than what I was seeing outside the car. But one year I just started hearing pieces that were reminiscent of it. Hélène Grimaud recorded is it Corigliano? I can't remember who wrote the theme in an ostinato, which includes the theme from Beethoven's Seventh, the Allegretto, and then Jacques Lussier did these jazz variations on the same theme. And then I was in the men's room at NPR one day, and they're playing classical music, and on came who was it? Was it a Schumann piece or something that was a total steal from this? And I felt, well, look, you know, since I kept on wanting to tell people about this, my friends and colleagues, the best solution to that dilemma was to do a piece on the air, you know, if I felt it was that interesting. So we did one.
I think there was a particular moment when Beethoven's Seventh resounded in your memory in Germany.
Yes, I had been to Germany several times reporting when I was based in London, and then after I came back home. And I'd been to Berlin a couple of times, into East Berlin and down into Dresden in the days of a divided Germany. The day when the wall cracked, the day when people began breaching the Berlin Wall, I was sent in a plane to get over there. And so I arrived on day two, actually, of the wall coming down. The little chip that hangs in my house is one day later than most people's chips of the wall. But I remember getting up in a hotel on the Kurfürstendamm and looking out the window, and what you saw were families of East Berliners walking through the West together. Many of them had been to West Berlin, but you couldn't take your family with you. The whole idea was that if you split, you might not see your family for years. And so now people were exercising this freedom to stroll through their city, the part of it that had been to them walled off. And on the television set, which I turned on looking for news, was a performance of Beethoven's Seventh and this theme. And I was listening to this soundtrack of what I'm looking at outside, and it seemed to be just a perfect match. I think I can't remember the line I used in the story I did, but it was something about life and art in perfect mutual imitation.
We think of the Ode to Joy as a great, you know, paean to freedom and humanity, but it's sort of interesting that I think so many people would agree with you that Allegretto from the Seventh Symphony, as a great instrumental piece, really makes Beethoven's spirit more resonant, more so than, you know, Goethe or Schiller or any of those folks. Something that I think Beethoven makes universal to all listeners.
I think that's true.
I know you've interviewed so many classical musical greats in your time. Yo-Yo Ma, Placido Domingo, Lauren Mazel, Joanne Folletta, a good friend of ours, to name just a few. And even one of our From the Top kids, 9-year-old Oscar Paz Suaznabar.
Yes, I heard you talking with Oscar on the radio at the time he was still 8 when you interviewed him. By the time that it aired and I got to him, he was 9. And he was from very nearby NPR's headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia. And I just thought the kid was remarkable at that age. And his mother brought him in, and I interviewed him. And he was that this wonderful mix that you're coming across all the time of childishness and of an intuition of maturity that is stunning. He talked about playing this sad piece by Glinka, The Lark. That was what he played for me at first. And that he wanted to feel sad as he was playing. This is young Stanislavski is talking to me about his method, you know. And he would summon sad thoughts, and I thought that's a pretty adult concept. The sad thought he would summon was about his bunny named Symphony, which he had lost. Bunny had the run of the backyard when the gate was closed during the days, and as Oscar put it, one day they came home and found the gate was open. So by some combination of events, Symphony had gone to see a larger audience somewhere beyond the backyard. And I thought the mix of this very mature project with this very childish experience was just fascinating and somehow instructive about how we develop and what capacities we have for mature thought when we're very young.
And tragedy, of Glinka manifested through an irrepressible 8-year-old mind. I think, given Oscar's character, and I remember his playing very, very well, I think my favorite composer under his hands is Haydn.
He talked about ebullience. The prankster. He talked about joking, and he played a part of a Haydn, or he played the Haydn sonata for me as well. It's terrifically impressive, and I was just totally charmed.
Yeah, great kid, Robert. You've been a major fan of From the Top, and that's a particular honor to me and our whole staff. What do you like about it?
What do I like about it?
Enough about me. What do you think about me?
I think first of all, I think it's a wonderful concept for a radio program because you talk with these young people and we hear both in what they say and how they say it, we hear their youth, we hear their adolescence, and then they play. And we don't see them, so we're not distracted or preoccupied with their youth at that moment. We just hear them play. Maybe the finest ears in the audience are hearing adolescence in the performance. I'm not. I don't have an ear that fine. So, to me, your program is kind of, it goes in waves. It's a conversation with a young person when we're hearing about the concerns and the hopes of youth. Then we're losing one's identity into the music, and it could be anybody playing for me. The piece of music takes over in the performance. And then we return to this young person with you, and we're sort of anchored once again in this young person's world. And I find the music, obviously, very, very satisfying, and it's part of our Sunday dinner routine. But I also find these conversations with the kids and that rhythm of the seeming contrast between their young personalities and their mastery of the instrument that they're playing.
It's a wonder to me as well every time we do it. Robert Siegel, thank you so much for your years of service and for helping to make NPR what it is today.
Oh, Christopher Riley, thank you very much.
This is Joanne Robinson, and just so you can understand what Robert and Chris are talking about, here is 8-year-old Oscar Paz Swaznavar on our show.
Welcome, Oscar. What are you going to play for us?
The Haydn Sonata in G Major, the third movement.
Excellent. The stage is yours.
Thank you.
Oscar Paz Swaznavar, age 8, from Alexandria, Virginia, here in the D.C. area, playing the Prestissimo from the Haydn Sonata number 52 in G.
Thanks for listening to this bonus content podcast. To hear Robert interview a 10-year-old pianist on one of our recent episodes, download Show 356, Boston, Massachusetts. And we'd love to hear from you. You can leave us a message on our Facebook page, facebook.com/fromthetopfans, or on Twitter @ClassicalKid. Or find us on iTunes and leave us a review.